Good evening and welcome to the Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and it's great to see you all here this evening. We're here for a special evening and a special talk. Thank you for coming out. As we begin, may I ask you, if you do have a cell phone or a pager, to please take it out and silence it for the benefit of both the speaker and the attendees, and we also video record our events for our website. This is the time of year when we do ask our members to support our annual fund. The money that we raise is critical to all of our operations, from our children's library to our readers' services and to building our collection and everything else that we do. So thank you for giving as generously as possible. It's my pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker, Maisie Houghton, who was a trustee of our library back in, I believe, the 1980s. And she's a native of New York, grew up in the city's environs and in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her experiences, insightfully detailed in Pitch Uncertain, her brand new book, both represent a culture now diminished and demonstrate Tolstoy's famous quote about the uniqueness of every problematic family. Following her talk, she will be glad to sign copies of our book, which our friends from the Corner Bookstore on Madison have available for you outside. So please join me in welcoming Maisie.
I don't know if it's really a diminishing culture that I'm writing about. I think this room represents a stronghold of a world that we all know well. But I love being here in the New York Society Library. As Mark said, my family came from New York. I was born here. And my sort of memories of my mother talking about receiving the books that came in the summer, all wrapped up in brown paper parcels. And you are right, I was a trustee. I think that my memory of being a trustee are sitting at a long table having sherry with Jacques Barzin, who said, it's ridiculous to have an annual fund appeal. We don't need that. And talking with Brendan Gill and Shirley Hazard, I don't remember contributing anything to the library, I mean, in knowledge or expertise, but it was great fun to be there. And at that point, when I was a trustee, there was another well-known woman named Ruth Draper. How many of you have ever heard of Ruth Draper? That if you know me, you know that I'm very interested in her. But she was a trustee, and she gave a map of the world that some student or some young friend had designed, showing the whole world and then, you know, with pinpricks where she'd been all over in her travels. And I, thinking about remembering that now, it seemed like such a, you know, kind of triumph of the 19th century. It was kind of, I have been here. Now we think of the world as such a tiny place, but there was this enormous map. I'm sad to say, I don't know if it's still in the basement, but it was moldering in the basement, sort of one of those things that they were going to have to do to repair it. But I feel honored to be at the library, but I also feel I'm a transgressor because I have done this terrible thing of writing a memoir. Now, we all know that many, many memoirs are being written now. I mean, I just read a review of Judy Collins, the singer, has just, I mean, I think it's her third book about herself, but that's just come out. And I also remember reading once an article about the best memoir was the one that General Grant wrote because he encapsulated so many different roles. He was a Civil War general, he could write about the military, he had business success, he had business failure, he was of course president, he was also struggled with alcohol, so he could write from the rehab point of view, and this was the consummate memoir, according to this reviewer. But on the other hand, there are also many people who, and I don't blame them, you can take a pot shot at all the many memoirs that are written. I save this article that came out in the New Yorker a little bit more than a year ago by Daniel Mendelsohn, when he talks about what he thinks of the memoir writer. Unseemly self-exposures, unpalatable betrayals, unavoidable mendacity, a soupçon of meretriciousness. Memoir, for much of its modern history, has been the black sheep of the literary family. Like a drunken guest at a wedding, it is constantly mortifying its soberer relatives, philosophy, history, literary fiction, spilling family secrets, embarrassing old friends, motivated, it would seem, by an overpowering need to be the center of attention. I wrote a memoir because one of the reasons is because I like to read them. I love the books. I mean, just thinking probably some of you know these people, Andre Aciman and Jill Kerr Conway, Diana Antill and Honor Moore, just naming a few. But they had particular resonance for me because they are the stories of the outsider. And even I, the ultimate WASP, can identify with that role. I came to write Pitch Uncertain. The name comes from something that was written on a report card that I received when I was about 10 from the music teacher. And she was clearly scratching her head, trying to think, what can I say? So it was just Pitch Uncertain. It came out, the actual process of writing the book came out of two rather default situations. The first was that my husband, Jamie, was in a terrible automobile accident. And even though I knew he was going to be all right, but after I had learned that my calling was not nursing, I decided that I would go back to what really meant something to me, which was writing. I mean, as a child, I sort of thought, oh, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up. You know, it seemed a worthy enterprise. And I consequently never did anything about it. I was married very young. I occupied myself with a totally 19th century kind of life. And I recognized at this time, which was about 15 years ago, go back to writing. Get off all these boards, good girl boards, and start again. And I took a class at the West Side Y by this wonderful teacher named Patty Dan, and she started us out with the class was advertised as for people who are over 50, who have lived and worked and want to tell their story. No experience necessary. So I thought, this is perfect for me. And she, in the class, she would give very simple exercises. Write about a car, a radio, an icebox, something that you remember from your childhood. And then she said, write about a relative. And this is where Ruth Draper comes in, because I had known Ruth Draper, who was an American monologuist, who performed great critical and public acclaim from about the 20s on to the early 50s. And she was a friend from an island in the summer in Maine, where my family and I had gone, and I'd grown up as a child. And she came back in this amazing gift from God, I'm going to write the great definitive biography of Ruth Draper. And her papers were in the New York Historical Society. This is in the days before the New York Historical Society, which I know is just reopened and all refurbished and glamorous now. But this was when it was very difficult to get in. You had to wait your turn, and they'd bring the papers in a big brown cardboard box and just flop them in front of you, and everything was held together with paper clips were rusting. But, I mean, I didn't know anything. I thought it was great. And I poured through all her letters and her correspondence with her sisters, because I think when she died, she lived right across the street, actually, here on 79th Street. They just took her desk and her bureau drawers and just dumped them in the New York Society Library, and not too many people had read them, except one woman who had been working on her biography for 25 years. And we became friends, and we kind of clucked over Ruth Draper like our child. You know, do you remember the 1933 when she was in London and all of that? But I did the unmentionable thing of giving a lecture at the Metropolitan Museum, and for the lecture, I asked the library if I could take a slide, to have slides made of this video that had been done of her, just before she died, in performing. And obviously for people who hadn't seen her, it was a wonderful boon, and this was just one night that I was doing it. But that was it with my competitor, and she threatened a lawsuit and said, "You're never to be allowed back in the library again." And this was one of the first times in my life that I really stood up for myself and said, "I'm sorry, you can't, you know, it's a public space, you can't turn me out." Anyway, her biography was published and mine wasn't. And it sat in, you know, I mean, I had sent it around to many people and talked about her a lot, but it was unpublished, except one editor who said to me, "You know, nobody cares about Ruth Draper," which I disagree with, but what's interesting in the story is how, because I'd mentioned and wove in a bit about how I knew her as a child in Maine, and this editor said, "You should write about these little girls. That's what I remember. But you probably don't want to do this." So it was sort of out of spite that I said, "Well, I am going to do it." And I began to weave sketches from the pieces that I'd written for Patty Dan at the West Side Y and into just my own memories of growing up in Cambridge in the 1950s. And that book, too, sat and was not published to great acclaim for several years. And then about 4 years ago, Corning, New York, and the western part of the state is really home. But my husband and I decided to spend more time in Boston to see some of our grandchildren. And in Boston, with my son, he himself had done a book about an anthology about men of his generation and how they had changed, and they were so much more involved in their family life. And he said, "You should show it to this man named Jock Heron, who has a small press." And I'd never met him, and I thought, oh, I just don't really want to do this. But I thought it's stupid not to just pursue one more time. But I just sent it off. I couldn't even look at it again. Popped it in the mail and never thought about it again. And then several months later, I'd completely forgotten that I'd done this. I got an email, and I recognized the name of the press, which is Tide Pool, and I thought, oh, I know what this is going to say. You know, "Thank you, we enjoyed reading it, but it's not for us." And then when he did say, "I want to, you know, let's talk, I'd like to publish it," I, you know, was thrilled, and what can I say? On my 70th birthday a year ago, we had a big party, and the book came out, and I can't help but be boastful and say now it's in its second printing with only, you know, I don't even know how many of the first copies were printed, but I'm glad, obviously, that it has appeared. But I wanted to just talk for a minute about this past year when I've been going about talking about the book to various organizations and nice libraries like this, and lots of people are very kind and say, "Oh, you know, it's a lovely reminiscence of the 50s, and I identify with that. And, you know, I'm always very happy to meet people who, one, read the book and then like it. But some of the other comments have been more people saying, well, nothing happens in this book. Why did you write it? And another person, this was on a blog, you know, they pass your book around. And the woman who wrote said, why doesn't she, me, Maisie Houghton, why doesn't she make up her mind about her father? She's ambivalent, and which is sort of the point of the book, one of the but it's also extremely hard for me, as much as a bid for attention, as Daniel mentions in writing a memoir, I still have a WASP reaction, that I recoil from talking, you know, it's that, oh, enough about me, talk about you, you know, I find it difficult to talk about myself. But one of the things that came up as the book was about to be published, Jock, the publisher, said, you know, this book is really about your parents. And I was so surprised. And I thought, oh, yes, that's right. Yes, there is quite a lot about my parents here in the book. And it was the sense, I suddenly had that terrible feeling of I've betrayed my parents, you know, I've talked about them. You know, I mean, there was nothing extraordinary. It was just that they were revealed in pen and ink. And I felt, by another person who wrote about memoir, saying, let's hear it for the lost art of shutting up, because I had, as I say, nothing sensational, but I had just spoken, written about my parents and their problematic marriage. They stayed together, but they were estranged, and I grew up in a household with three sisters in the 1950s in Cambridge, and it was nothing remarkable happened, but I wrestled with that feeling of what is true. And I think, as I know, my sister who is here, who has been wonderfully supportive about the book, but she said right from the start, I would write a very different story, even though the facts are there. And I feel, well, what am I really doing writing this story? Perhaps I'm more the set designer than the producer. I'm interested in, I mean, I want to assure you that everything in this book really did happen to me, but it's also how, what were people wearing? What were the color of her eyes? Where was the snow in our backyard in Cambridge? And I, that to me is what interested me. I think back on, I went to this wonderfully liberal school in Cambridge called Shady Hill, perhaps some of you know it, and in the fourth grade, the important fact, the whole year is really spent on studying the Greek gods and goddesses. As someone once said to one of our teachers, you know, these are mythical people, you know, because we all took it so seriously and we all believed that we were part of this Elysian fields. But I think of the story of Penelope and how she would retire every night after being wooed by the suitors, waiting for Ulysses, and she'd go up and rip out what she'd woven because she couldn't bear to have this story end and that she would go off with the unlikely suitor. And I began to feel, am I like Penelope, telling the same story over and over again, and I can't quite let go of it? But for me to tell this short story, because it really just ends when I graduate from college and marry my husband, who's still alive and well today, I feel that what I wanted to say was to create a sort of sense of order. It wasn't that it was chaotic, my childhood, but there was a certain sense of unease, and I wanted to document a childhood with its pleasures and anxieties, and after the story, after I finished writing this book, that it was really like a snake shedding its skin. I felt, you know, back to Penelope metaphor again. It's just a piece of fabric, and here it is, and do with it what you will. I hope that you enjoy it, but discard it and move on to something else. People ask me why I write. My publisher was insistent that this picture that was taken by my father, not, oh, my darling daughter, but much more, just he had a little Minox camera and he loved to go around taking pictures. And I remember reading in bed and being very irritated and looking up at him. But anyway, they chose this for the cover of the book. And then he said, pitch uncertain. We've got to tie this all in. And he wanted to say, a mid-century middle daughter finds her voice. And, you know, well, I was putty in his hands. I mean, I wanted the book to come out, so I did, whatever. But I don't really feel, you know, everybody says, oh, it's so great you found your voice. I don't really feel, you know, sometimes my voice is very sweet, and sometimes it's very strident, and sometimes it's very coy. And I am perplexed as to, I would like to think, oh, I found my, you know, standing on my soapbox, but that isn't quite the way it's turned out. Still, when people say, well, what do you think about writing? I love the story of Daniel Pinsky, who is poet, I think you say poet laureate, anyway, he was the Library of Congress for a few years, and he's a Boston poet. And people were asking him about, why do you write? And, you know, he said, well, I'm sort of like the child in kindergarten, and you're given colored paper and bits of, you know, macaroni, you know, pasta, and then you pin them on the paper and make a design, and then the teacher puts it up on the bulletin board, and you feel, this is a great achievement. So that rang a real bell with me. So what I would like to do now is just to read very briefly from the book, and then I would love to answer any questions. You know, I'm going to start at the very beginning because I feel this is, this is the first chapter, and it's, yes, it is called Pitch Uncertain. I was born in 1940, a bad time for the world, but I never did anything bad until the day I cut off my hair and left it on the floor for my mother to find, a bright hot pool of yellow curls. I was 4. It was wartime, and we were living in a rented house in Winter Park, Florida. My father, an officer in the Navy, had recently been stationed there. My mother and I, along with Sybil, my older sister by 2 years, and Elizabeth, or Tizzy, a new baby of 2 months, had moved from New York City to be near him. Florida, despite all its palm trees and relentless sunlight, seemed dark to me, the people and the houses. Unaccustomed to southern heat, my mother kept the old verandaed house heavily shaded. The blinds were always down, the curtains drawn. Someone was always taking a nap, my mother, my father, but not together, the amorphous baby. Sybil and I tiptoed around the closed doors, but when we went outside, the glittering light hurt our eyes. In the kitchen was Lily May, the black maid. Marion Skillen, a trained nurse from Naples, Maine, was also there. Uncertain in a new land, my mother had persuaded Marion to make the long journey south. Marion, all starched whiteness and squeaking rubber-soled shoes, stuck to the new baby upstairs. Lily May ironed endless rivers of laundry and passed dead-looking platters of food in the shadowy dining room. My father was almost never there. When he did appear, it was often with a swirl of laughing young pilots in uniform. They brought us all shells from the beach that we never visited, They set us on their knees, putting down their drinks to balance us on their laps. The afternoon I rebelled, my mother was a long while on the telephone. She wasn't the type to chatter on. She served as a sounding board to solve other people's problems. My mother had been called to the telephone during a rare treat. We had been having lunch alone together. Her low voice burred on as she twisted the cord in her hand. What was she saying? To whom was she speaking? I slipped away from the dining room table, wandering sulkily through the muted rooms. On my mother's desk, a pair of scissors gleamed. Long and sleek, they were grown-ups' scissors, not the stubby, disappointingly blunt ones we used for paper dolls. I ran my hand over my head. My hair was the one thing about me that was different. In everything else, I matched my sister. Our seersucker dresses, our red sandals, our black eyes. But Sybil had two brown pigtails, while I still had a baby's fuzz of buttery curls. I thought about Marion Skilling in the mornings, twisting my hair into ringlets, wrestling the ribbon to the top of my head. There now, aren't you sweet? Now go and be good. Suddenly it was easy to pick up the slender weapon and start to cut. One tentative snip, and then I was possessed with the necessity to act and be done with my boldness. My curls fell away like skin being shed by a snake. It went so fast I hardly knew what I was doing. I crept back to the kitchen to face Lily May. She stared silently. "Your mama be upset," she said, shaking her head as she moved through the swinging door with a stack of freshly ironed shirts. A little panic seized me, but almost gleefully I hurried to stand defiantly before my mother. She was still sitting, unspeaking, by the telephone. She seemed unmoved. "Heavens, what did you do that for? It will take forever to grow out." Marion peered at me over the banister railing. "You've lost your looks," she sniffed. My mother guided me toward the dining room. "We must finish lunch," she murmured, rousing herself. The table looked half ravaged, like my hair, with crumpled napkins and tired lettuce on the plates. I started to weep at the enormity of what I had done. Fat tears fell on my grilled cheese sandwich. "Don't fuss, darling," consoled my mother distractedly. She wasn't even looking at me. There was an unspoken lesson in that afternoon. My mother should have been angry, but instead she held her tongue. Was it at that point that I learned to guard the peace, to mind my manners, to keep my mouth shut? And then on my report card, the music teacher wrote, "Pitch uncertain." In school, someone would grab me from behind on the playground. "Whose side are you on? Lucy's, the charismatic troublemaker, or Kitten's, the charismatic good girl?" It seemed easier and smarter to keep my mouth shut. One day I came home from school, tense and weepy from trying to please everyone. My mother uncharacteristically drew herself up and exhorted me to stick by your guns, have the courage of your convictions. Most important of all, be yourself. But how do I know who I am, I wondered. Growing up, I swam like a fish in the clouded waters of family life. And then I go on in the chapter and talk about my parents and their where they came from. And I just read the end of this chapter. "Thus my parents found each other almost by predestination. Like storybook figures, they had once been in love, but then drifted into the lonely estrangement that was to mark my growing up years. In the marriage, my mother led, not by dominance, but by passivity. She was always there to pick up the pieces. Sybil J., that was her name, had been born the gentle doe of a country gentry family with a glamorous father herself. It never occurred to her to say, no, or I want, or even I. She was the Cinderella in our house, not only physically doing all the work, cooking our meals, driving the carpool, mowing the lawn, but morally holding the fort against the dazzling prince, my father. My father was Quicksilver, brilliant, elusive, with a fountain of friends, buddies, and sweethearts, while my mother stood for decorum, convention, and security. Her imprint was firm. We daughters adored her, wanting to protect her from this errant Pied Piper, her husband. Witty, irreverent, mercurial, he never got over being his mother's favorite. Good-looking to the point of flashy, with black hair and green eyes, he was forever part of the martini generation, and one drink would set him off. One never knew in what direction, whether on a reel of funny stories or in a flash of temper. Never very mature, always appealing, he was a confused and confusing father. But if the memory of my father is in high relief, the memory of my mother is as the underside of an intaglio, smooth and bright on the surface, underneath, deep, powerful, the negative force. A stern guardian of her three daughters, she kept us as reined in and checked as she held herself. Still, I liked playing my cards close to my chest. I was the middle of three, forever observing, silently absorbing the family scene. At home, after school, at the end of the afternoon, I would often find my grandmother, my mother's mother, and mother talking to each other over the tea tray in low, confiding tones. I pressed close to them, happy they were together, for once sitting down in peace. Their strong, knobby, long-fingered hands were the same as they drew teacups to their lips, laid aside reading glasses and knitting needles, or gave the last polish to the crossword puzzle. They each revered the other and could never see enough of each other. My widowed grandmother, often away on restless travels, my dutiful mother, so engulfed in household responsibilities. As I approached, the conversation would fade off. Least said, soonest mended, my grandmother would murmur, and a dark eyebrow would arch ever so slightly. I burrowed nearer and pretended to read my book. If I was quiet for long enough, those consoling voices would resume, and I would find out something interesting. Some baffling, unconnected piece of information would float out of their mysterious circle of talk and lodge itself in my consciousness, like a dust speck in the eye. Someone was leaving, someone was coming home, someone was unhappy, but she would get over it because she was so young. I was hooked on the grown-up world. Thank you very much. So, thank you. I thank you very much. I would love to answer any deep, long, thoughtful questions. It's an embarrassingly long time ago. I was in 1993. That's almost 20 years ago. So I'm not the other title that I wanted to call this book. But curiously enough, someone that my publisher had just published the book, but with I called it originally Late Bloomer. So that is what I was, definitely. Yes.
Did you, over the years, keep a journal? And if so, did that play a part in your ultimately writing the memoir?
You know, I now have a journal that I love, that's much too lurid to be published, but as a child, I had these diaries, again, you know, it was with the little lock and all of that. And I must say that I put them away but found them, not when I was doing the book, but I, you know, obviously was interested and opened them up. And they were the most boring things that I've ever read. They were just, I went to school, I had mathematics, I had English, I came home, we fooled around in the afternoon, and, you know, that was it every day. So I can't really say, I mean, now you could say, oh, I was suppressing so much, but they were extremely correct records of that time. Yes.
So now that you do keep a journal that you don't want published, do you see inspirations from your own life and
Well, in the sense, would I use the journals to write something else?
Yes, it's an inspiration that's a starting point, not to take literally.
Yes, no, I mean, you know, I mean, now I pretend to myself that I'm writing again, ha-ha. It's very hard to get back into writing, but I thought that I would write short stories, and because I've never done that, because I did the biography and then the memoir, and I'm sure Ved is here, as many, some of you are probably all writers. No one ever is supposed to say, oh, I used this, this happened to me, I'm going to put it in a book, but I definitely, in the short story, it's totally autobiographical, except that I call the character Margot, not Maisie. Thank you. Oh, sorry, Henry.
Are you going to write a sequel beginning at the age of 20 when this one ends?
A sequel to my life?
A sequel to your first 20 years.
Oh,
like your
oh.
Next 20 years.
No, I think that would be, as I said, much too sensational. I couldn't possibly write it. You know. Thank you all very much for coming. I'm very happy that you came.